Carol Maurer and Flaviano Spring Packaging. Thanks, Steph. Okay, so thanks so much for the invitation to talk. It's a great pleasure to be here. That's my title, that's me, and that's my affiliation, both of which are different from what you might find on the web. Okay, so this talk is going to be based on principally three papers, which two of which have come out, and one of which is going to come out. So with Daniel Camardes, Fernando Carreiro, Shehu Abbasalam, Karim Surilis, and it's also going to use some results from two old papers from last year, with BJ Balasubramanian and Bobo. Okay, so the structure of the talk is going to be as follows. I'm going to start by motivating the problem to say, why is this an important question to address? Why is it useful? As an answer to that is going to be related to supersymmetry and soft terms, I'm then going to give a basic review of the MSSM, soft supersymmetry breaking, and what you would like your string compact application to tell you, so you can then take that and then go to a phenomenologist and say, what does this predict? Then I'll come to the main part of the talk, which is how you can compute K-metrics from the behaviour of the physical equivalent couplings. Having described the techniques, I'm then going to apply them for two particular models. So I'm going to apply them for a one-modulus KKRT model and for the large volume models. And then finally, I'm going to also discuss applications to the actual computation of soft terms, what you get, and also to neutrino masses. And then I'll conclude. Okay, so let me start with the motivation. Okay. Well, it's big, it's bad, and it's coming. And it's coming soon. And we all want to prepare for it. And it's very, very important. It is, of course, the LHC. And it's going to probe the Terra scale in unprecedented detail. In particular, it's going to go beyond Fermilab by roughly a factor of 10, both in luminosity and in beam energy. So, if supersymmetry exists, and it's responsible for stabilising the weak hierarchy, then it will most probably be discovered at the LHC. Now, for formal theorists, this is also another opportunity, because low energy supersymmetry is one of the best possibilities for connecting string theory, or indeed any high energy theory, to data, by trying to work out how supersymmetry is broken, and then trying to convert that into soft masses for things like sports and phenotypes. So, in the business that gets called string phenomenology, understanding supersymmetry breaking and trying to predict the pattern of the superpartners is one of the most important tasks there is. And there's a huge literature on this going back 20 years. So, let me just review the basics of the MSSM and supersymmetry breaking. So, what is the MSSM? So, the MSSM, as we know, is the minimal supersymmetric standard model. So, that's the matter content. But also, the name's a bit odd because the MSSM isn't actually supersymmetric. In any phenomenological analysis, you also add soft breaking terms. The soft breaking terms are characterized by those terms you can add to the Lagrangian of the supersymmetric MSSM, which breaks supersymmetry softly. What breaking it softly means is it's an explicit breaking, so the Lagrangian is explicitly not supersymmetric, but it's what's called soft breaking, i.e. you do not reintroduce any quadratic divergences. The terms you can add were classified yonks and yonks ago, and they come in four forms. So you've got soft scalar masses, so this is something like a squawk mass or a slepton mass. You've got Gaugino masses, a mass for the Guino, the Wino, the Bino, and so on. You've got the trilinear terms, which are always called the A terms, which are trilinear scalar A terms. So that would be like a squawk triple coupling or something. And then you've also got B terms, which only apply for the Higgs, or the two Higgs levels. So, in the ideal world, Voltaire wrote a book about us living in the best of all possible worlds. Now, that's probably not true, but let's hope that we do live, physics-wise, in the best of all possible worlds. And in that best of all possible worlds, the LHC is going to give lots and lots of direct experimental information about all these terms. And then our task as theorists is to try and beat experimentalists to the spectrum. Again, in the best of all possible worlds. Okay. A phenomenologist might just care about what are the subjects? If you're coming from something like string theory, or any kind of high-scale theory, then you say, you're going to ask, what generates the soft terms? Why do they have the values they do? And practically, the soft terms are always generated by two things. The mechanism of supersymmetry breaking, how supersymmetry is broken, and then how this is transmitted to the observer itself. So this is the kind of the most top-level classification of supersymmetry breaking. So examples are gravity mediation, which is the kind of the classic way almost. So this is, you break supersymmetry in a hidden sector, and you communicate it to the observer of the sector through non-normalizable supergravity contact interactions. Another example is gauge mediation. So this is, in a sense, visible sector supersymmetry breaking, that you break supersymmetry through particles that are charged under the standard model gauge groups. And finally, anomaly mediation, where you have Susie breaking through loop effects. And these all have characteristic features and scales. So my talk's going to be about gravity mediation, so let me just review that in a bit more detail. Okay, so in gravity mediation, what key problems? So supersymmetry is, it's broken in a hidden sector. In strict classifications, this normally means the moduli sector. It's communicated to the observer sector through non-normalizable supergravity contact interactions. And these interactions are suppressed by the plaxicon. So if you then say you have some hidden sector model, how big are the soft terms? How big are the superpartners? The naive expectation is the scale you break supersymmetry divided by the Planck scale. So that when the scale you break supersymmetry is the F terms for the hidden sector fields that break supersymmetry. We want to observe this, so we want this to be a TEV, and we want to stabilize hierarchy, so we want this to be a TEV. And this tells us the F terms, roughly, ought to be around 10 to the 11 GeV in order to get the right scale of soft terms. And this scale of 10 to the 11 GeV is often called the intermediate scale. Okay, so how do you actually compute soft terms? So, I don't know if we're not planning to go into all the details here, because the formulae are pretty technical, but so I'll get across just the basic points, which is, you start the computation by you take the supergravity, Kähler potential, the superpotential, and then you expand them in a power series expansion in the matter fields. The rationale for this is that the matter fields you think should basically have either zero or tiny vefs, whereas moduli fields can have huge vefs. I mean, they have large classical vefs, unlike or the ordinary matter fields. Okay, so in this expansion, phi, everywhere it appears, denotes one of the moduli fields, and C denotes a matter field. So, for example, take the top line, you expand the full superpotential as the part that just depends on the moduli, plus the part that is quadratic in matter fields, plus the part that is cubic in matter fields, and so on. And what enters into the computation of soft terms are all these things here. So the mu term, which might be a function of the moduli, the Yukawa couplings, which are a function of the moduli, the matter metrics, which are a function of the moduli, z term, which is a function of the moduli, and of course the true level, Kähler potential, the superpotential, the moduli fields. Okay, so all this talk is going to focus on this guy. This is the matter metric, the Kähler metric for the matter fields. And it's crucial in computing the soft terms, but obviously because it determines the normalization of the matter fields. So you kind of, you know, it's obviously important. And given this expansion, the computation of the physical soft terms is reasonably straightforward once you've identified your minimum. Or at least it's straightforward in principle. So let me give the formulae for what the soft scalar mass is and trilinears are once you're sitting at a particular minimum.
You didn't have your cup of being the Higgs's and the matter fields. Is that just because there's not room in this library?
Oh, so C is meant to represent like a generic mathematically.
Including H.
Yes, including H. I've written H out specifically because the mu term and the z term only apply for H in the MSSM. So that's why they appear specifically here. But everywhere else, C is just any math field at all. Okay, so these are the formulae. If you've seen them before, they're familiar. If you haven't seen them before, I'm not going to be using them, so you don't need to pay really that much attention. The point I really want to make is that you look at all these formula, and K tilde, which is the metric, is everywhere. So if you have your string compactification, and you want to make some kind of prediction for what soft terms you're going to see at the LHC, you need to have some control over this guy, because otherwise you're not predicting anything. Okay, so this is emphasising the importance of being able to get control over computing the Kähler metric. However, the problem is that the Kähler metric is non-polymorphic, and thus it's less protected, and it's generally harder to compute than any polymorphic property. Okay, so the purpose of this talk is going to be to describe techniques to compute this Kähler potential. So we start with what's known, because obviously this is a problem that's been well studied. So for Clavier backgrounds, the Kähler metrics for non-chiral D3 and D7 position moduli, and also D7 Wilson line moduli, have been computed by dimensional reduction. So the D7, the mathometric for the D7 position moduli depends on the dilaton, whereas that for D3 moduli depends on the T fields, the K moduli. In Tori, we know you can always do more because you can quantize the string. So, using explicit string scattering computations, the mathematics for chiral D7 have been computed in 2B toroidal backgrounds. And they've got a scaling like this. So, obviously, there's dependence on lots of other moduli here. The reason I'm focusing on the T moduli is these are all my comments. The techniques I'm going to give apply to the behaviour of the T moduli. So the purpose of this talk is to describe some new techniques which allow you to get some control over the mathometric for chiral fields on a Calabi Yang. And the techniques, I'm going to apply them to chiral D77 matter in type 2B compactifications. Well, more particularly the sort of type 2B juxta compactifications. That's what I kind of really want to use the results. And I'm going to compute the module dependence of the mathometrics from the module dependence of the physical Yukawa couplings. So I'll say now that the guts of the talk is about going from physical Yukawa couplings to the Kähler metric. And so this is going to need to use to look at how Yukawa couplings arrive at supergravity. So let me do that now. Okay, so now we're beginning to move from review to the actual how you do this computation. Okay, so in supergravity, the Yukawa couplings arise from these terms, which you can find in the right appendix of Wessenbach. So you've got the mathometric, and then you've got the superpotential. The superpotential always appears with an e to the k over 2. So if you expand this out, you've got the kinetic term plus the trilinear coupling. Now, obviously, the matter fields aren't quantity normalized. So, the question, if you say, what's the physical Yukawa coupling? We have to bring down the factors of the matter metric. And so, the physical Yukawa coupling then gets three factors of the matter metric for each field here. And there's a factor of 1/2, because obviously, to normalize this, it's the square root of the.
Sure, I'm sorry, is k tilde alpha supposed to be understood with an alpha bar against all field?
Sorry, okay, so this is assuming. Okay. Yeah, so this is assuming diagonal mathematics. So, okay, so properly this should be a full sum over like C bar j. And then this would be then k tilde I j bar. So let me just write that.
Right, that's the short. the yellow box there.
So the filtering would be. And then if this kind of reduces to diagonal matching objects, then this is sort of. And then a kind of further kind of contraction notation to just to pay off that. So I'll say that even though I'm going to use this notation for diagonal matching metrics, the results will extend to non-diagonal matching metrics. But I'm going to explain that later when I talk about flight. Okay, so the point is physically coupled couplings are given by this formula. And this formula is going to be the central one, the central formula for commutations. So even though it's going to be on several transparencies, right above on the board. So the point is, in this formula, okay, we know the tree-level moduli potential, which is k-hat. And in 2D compactifications, this is given by this. What we want to do is to compute the modular dependence of the matter metric from the modular dependence of the physical Yukawa couplings. And what I'm going to do is work in a power series expansion and determine the leading power lambda, i.e., to expand the matter metric as a power series in the K moduli, T, and determine the leading power.
I'm sorry, so K hat and K tilde are.
So K hat is the K potential for the moduli,
okay.
And K tilde is the matter. So, again,
and the Y alpha beta gamma is the usual thing you would compute by three derivatives of pre potential and so on, is that right?
Why
alpha beta gamma without the scaling?
So
not Y hat, but just Y.
Yes, so why is the super potential Yukawa coupling? Yeah. So how do you compute it?
Okay.
Yeah.
And the T's are two cycle volumes or four cycle volumes?
Four cycle volumes, this is two. Okay, so we're going to compute this as a power series. This is a sensible thing to do, because if you're going to blow up, if you blow up everything up to large volume, blow all the cycles up, there's obviously going to be a kind of geometric limit, and wherever the leading power in the power series is, that's what we're going to compute. I mean, there has to be a leading power, and that's the thing. That's the kind of the classical leading power, and that's what we're going to go for. And that's often called the modular way of the field. Okay, so the other point we can make is, well, I say we are unable to compute the super potential Yukawa coupling, but I should really say I'm unable to compute the super potential Yukawa coupling. So, you know, if anyone would like to do that, that's fine. But I'm assuming I've got no knowledge at all about I've got no way to compute how a certain moduli appears in the superpotential coupling. So in other words, if the superpotential does depend on some modulus, then even if you knew everything about the physical Yukawa couplings, you'd be able to get no normal information at all about the matter metrics, because this is an overdetermined problem. However, things aren't quite as bleak as that, because there are some moduli that just don't appear in the superpotential at all. Or at least they don't appear in the superpotential imperturbation theory. And in particular, in 2D compactifications, the T moduli, the K moduli, do not appear perturbatively in the superpotential. So in perturbation theory, this vanishes. And there is no dependence of Y alpha beta gamma on the T moduli.
If it appears in the superpotential, I mean, how could it be modulus if it appears in the superpotential? Wouldn't it necessarily have a potential, and so would it be flat?
So I'm just using modulus to refer to any string. I mean, okay, so I'm using modulus as it's used in things like the 2B flux applications and wherever when. I mean, even, you still call them moduli even though they have a potential.
Including the complex structure ones in that case. Say, that would be an example of something which is in the superpotential, but not.
So certainly the 2B superpotential depends on the complex structure moduli. Right. And that's going to be it, why I have to be together. Yeah. Okay, so here's the structure of the computation. We know the moduli plane potential. We know that this guy doesn't depend on the team fields. So if we can compute this, we can then work back to work out what this is. Now this might seem a bit crazy, because you say, well, you don't know what's in the superpotential of parallel couplings, how on earth can you work out what physically parallel couplings are? But actually this isn't as hard as it sounds. And in 2D compactifications, we can carry this out through wave function moduli, which is the kind of physical origin of your carbon couplings for in 2D applications. So now what I'm going to do is describe how we compute the scaling behavior of the physical carbon couplings for chiral matter living on a stack of magnetized disintegrates. Okay, so what's the geometry going to be? I'm going to basically consider a stack of magnetized grains. So they've got some two-form flux on. They're all wrapped in an identical cycle. And if the grains are magnetized, chiral fermions can stretch between differently magnetized grains. And this is kind of a typical geometry in kind of grains and singularity models. This is the kind of geometry you have, except it's often at a singularity. But if you imagine just resolving the singularity and blowing it up, then you get something which looks like this. Okay, so another way of saying it, a more visual picture, we've got all the grains wrapped in this cycle I call blow up. And there's different flux turned on, which with different colours. And this is what gives you, or can give you, chirality. Okay, so we're using, how do we compute the scaling of the physical decoys? Well, it's a simple computational technique. The physical decoys are determined by the triple overlap of normalised wave functions. And these wave functions can be computed, in principle, by just dimensionally reducing CPM mills or the DBI action on this cycle. Okay, so any questions up to now before I go on to the dimensional reduction?
Is it really important how much fluxes are turned on? Is it these are Maxwell fluxes or is it Ramondamon or?
These are two-form fluxes on the cycle. Though I'm going to kind of work in what we call the dilute flux limit, where the cycle size is really large, in which the fluxes, their only kind of imprint really is they give you chiral fermions. Because I can't control what happens if I'm in a small body limit where the flux quantization is important.
But if these are fluxes in the supergravity model, but from the point of view of the supergravity, is that right?
These are fluxes on the world volume of the brain. So I'm considering a stack of D7s wrapping a four cycle. The Lemmensch limit of the DBI is going to reduce to super Young mills. And super Young mills is given by this. Now, if we have magnetic flux in the brain, then we get chiral fermions in the Lemmensch spectrum. But we can't get chiral fermions. I'm assuming we do have chiral fermions. And these fermions come from dimensional reduction of the gauge ego. And they're counted topologically by the number of solutions to the Dirac equation. And also just make a comment that even though I'm saying this on the four cycle, I mean, this is also exactly what happens in the heterotic spectrum, where you can think of everything as being sort of D9 brains, as it were. And you can physically, the carbon couplings all come from dimensionally reducing this guy. Okay, so the full action to be reduced is DBI rather than two chemicals. But in the limit where cycle volume is large, the magnetic fluxes all become dilute, and the DBI action is going to reduce to that of two chemicals. And the results I'm going to give are only going to hold within this large cycle volume dilute flux approximation. So another way of putting it is what I'm trying to say is that I've got some cycle. In the geometric limit, I'm planning to be able to get the leading power. As you shrink the cycle down, obviously all hell breaks loose, and you really reduce control. So it's working in the limit of large cycle problems. Okay, so where do the curves come from? Okay, so we consider the high-dimensional term here. Now, if you dimensionally reduce this, you can see that basically the Gugino-Gugino term is going to give you kinetic terms, whereas the Gugino-Gugino term is going to give you curl brackets. And the size of the physical Ducarl couplings are going to be completely set by the combination of the above. Because this is going to determine the normalization, and so the ratio of these two things is going to give you the magnitude of the physical Ducarl couplings. Okay, so where do the kinetic terms come from? As usual, we decompose the Gugino into kind of a part in the forward dimensions and a part in the extra dimensions. I've written psi 6 here. This is just to know that this is supported within the Calabi-Yau. And it's supported on the brain within the Calabi-Yau. I mean, it's only supported on the fourth cycle, but because it's in the extra dimensions, that's why I've given it subscript 6. And we do the same for components of the gauge vessel. So then the reduced kinetic term is just this guy, splitting this up. And if we want to have the kinetic term canonically normalized, we just require that the wave function in the extra dimensions it integrates to 1 over the 4 cycle. The Ducarl couplings. Again, these are just coming straight from dimensional reduction. And this, the integration, the overlap integral of the wave functions and the extra dimensions is what determines the magnitude of the four-dimensional Ducarl couplings. And the physical Ducarl couplings are determined by just this normalized overlap integral where you're using properly normalized wave functions on the brain. And where properly normalized means that they're integrating up to 1. Okay, so now let's get what we're after. Okay, so said that the normalized wave functions, the normalization conditions here, the physical Ducarl couplings are given by this integral, this overlap integral with normalized wave functions. So for canonical kinetic terms, we need to have the wave function on the cycle scales as the inverse square root volume of the cycle, satisfy this. And if you look at the scaling normalization, you also need this. And so then, this integral is sort of something we can do easily. You get a factor, the fact of integrating over the cycle gives you a factor of volume, and then each one of these wave functions gives you a factor of inverse square root of volume. So then overall, you get inverse square root of volume. And this gives you the scaling of the physical Ducarl couplings with the K-module. For we have static D7 brains, chiral fermions coming from magnetic flux on those D7 brains.
There's no warping going on, that's why you don't distinguish warp line as the body.
Yeah, there's no warping going on. This is I mean, I don't know what happened. Okay, so let me just make a comment about this. So, one question you might ask is, under the cycle we're scaling, why should the wave function just scale simply, going as the inverse volume of the cycle? Why shouldn't it just do something completely crazy? So the answer is that because the T-module don't appear in the physical, it's only in superconnection of Ducarl couplings. And recall that the origin of Ducarl couplings is through wave function. So, okay, looking at this formula, you can see that because T don't appear here, you can't have a completely crazy behaviour of the wave function, because that would alter the texture rather than just the overall scale of the physical Ducarl couplings. But to alter the actual texture of this, you've got to alter the superpotential Yukawa coupling, which means altering the complex structure much less. Okay, let me just say that argument again, because it's a little complicated. The reason the wave functions must scale simply under a rescaling cycle volume is because the T moduli don't appear in the superpotential, and so they're triple overlap. You can't change the form of the triple overlap. You can only change the scale. To change the form, you need to alter the complex structure moduli, which you haven't done. And the other comment I make is that this result for scaling only holds in the classical limit, large cycle volume, dilute fluxes. Okay, so this ends the kind of the main describing the techniques section of the talk. So if you have any questions about that, now would be a good time to ask.
So what we're doing this for is we're trying to infer the T dependence of the K's, right?
Yes.
So are you going to tell us how they are?
Yes, so now, okay, so that's their model to make. So now the next part of the talk, I'm going to then infer the T dependence of the K's for certain models. Okay, so far what we've done, as Cliff says, is we've determined how the physical Yukawas scale. Now I want to go back and turn that into a question of how do the Kalin metrics scale. Okay, so, first application, one modulus KKLT. So, in a one modulus KKLT example, all chiral matter is going to be supported on D7 grains wrapping a single full cycle, which I've called T. From above, said that the physical Yukawa couplings scale as 1 over the square root of the cycle volume. We know the moduli Kalin potential, which is just minus 3 log t plus t bar. And so, as the superpotential doesn't depend on t in any way, you just plug this through and you work out that the matter Kalin potential must scale as 1 over t plus t bar to the 2/3. The next application I give are large volume models, which are a class of models that are developed by Vijay Balasubramanian, Herbert, and myself, and Fernando Cabello. And so let me just draw the geometry. So the geometry is that there's a huge, huge, huge bulk. So when I say huge, I mean about 10 to 15 the string units here. And then you've got a small blow-up cycle of order size about 10 the string units. And the idea is that we're going to support the standard model on grains, these 7 grains wrapping this small 4 cycle. And we want to work out the dependence of the matter metrics on the cycle sizes. So as I said, the overall volume is very large, and there's also small cycles. For the simplest model, which is P41169, the Kalin potential looks like this. And we can interpret this cycle, TS, as a local blow-up cycle. And what I want to do is I want to wrap grains on this cycle and work out the dependence of the matter metric on the Kalin moduli. So, let me draw another picture. So this volume 10 to 15 LS6, this is a small 4 cycle with volume 4 cycle being about 10 LS to the 4. And so there are two moduli, TB, which is about 10 to the 10, and TS, which is size about 10. Volume is TB to 3/2 minus TS to 3/2. Okay. So the physical Yukawa couplings is local, and thus is independent of the volume. So this is something that you kind of know from Brains of Singularities. that it's a meaningful question to put your brain in the singularity and say, what are the equality companies? What's the field theory on the brain? Without having to worry about the fact you're using a non-complex space and your singularity is zooming off to infinity. Well, yeah, you don't need to worry about the complex space to study equality companies. So the simple fact that the physical equality coupling is independent of the volume allows you to deduce purely from locality with no other considerations that the matter metric has got to scale as 1 over volume to the 2/3. And as this is for a Clarke-Yau-Back ring, this is already a non-trivial result. However, we can go further. If we put all the brains wrapping this small four cycle, then we worked out earlier that the physical Yukawa couplings should scale as 1 over the square root of the volume of that four cycle. And again, using the same logic as before, that we know k hat, we know y hat, and we know y doesn't depend on t fields, we can then deduce that the matter metric scales as the volume of the force cycle to the power 1/3 divided by the overall Clarke-Yau volume to the power 2/3. And this gives the dependence on small cycle moduli. Okay, so a couple of comments. The dependence 1 over volume to 2/3 follows purely, simply, and entirely from the requirement that the physical Yukawa couplings are local. The dependence on the small cycle volume follows from the specific brain configuration. All D7 brains wrapping the same small cycle.
Does your reliance on the large volume and the approximations mean that this is the leading asymptotic form of a more complicated function than the functional time of SMB?
Yes, so it should be interpreted as the leading term in a power series expansion in tau s, and the leading term in a power series expansion with the.
So there's two series going on, you've got the leading one for both.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so if you put the brains in a large cycle, then it's really like the one we'll just take out example, and you get the matter metric goes as 1 over t to the 2/3, where t is now the t for the big cycle. I also want to return to a previous comment, where I said that back at the beginning, where I said it doesn't really matter whether you're using diagonal or non-diagonal matter metrics. And the reason for this is that t moduli don't see flame, because they don't appear up here. And therefore, the t-dependence is flavor universal. It's just an overall prefactor. It's not something. So if you have a diagonal matter metric, or you have a non-diagonal matter metric, it doesn't really matter. From the point of view of the t-moduli, there's no difference. They can't see flavor. They can't see the difference between the top quark and the upper quark. Okay, so this has now described the application of these results to one modulus KKLT and to the large volume models. Well, one thing I'd like to emphasize is that these techniques allow, even though it's the leading term of power system expansion, they do allow you to get results for the K-mode potential on the Clarke-Yau, which is quite a non-trivial thing to do. The next part of this talk, I'm going to apply this to the computation of soft terms and neutrino masses. So, again, I'd like you to ask any questions now before I go.
So there is some little k alpha, which in a t-scaling is going to multiply, and that's something which is determined by the other moduli, the complex structure moduli, let's say. And you're going to get results for these things. Now you're actually going to work out soft terms and neutrino masses that are independent of little k alpha.
So little k alpha is dependent on
alpha. I'm not sure, but I thought that was the thing which was multiplied by your scaling.
Yes, yeah, so that's the dependence on the complex structure moduli. So that's where all the flavor physics is.
Okay.
And we haven't got anything, I can't say anything about that.
So you assume an appropriate normalization for that and put the rest of t or something like that?
Yes, yeah, so what we're claiming to get is to get the t behavior. And so things like the flavor physics, I'm just not saying anything about that. It's a different problem, and I can't fix it, so I won't fix it. I can't fix it. Okay. So soft terms. So at the beginning I gave a formula for how you go from given a vacuum, how you go from expansion of Taylor potential and Seeger potential in order to get explicit soft terms. I'm sure you all love to see all the details, but I'm going to give you none of them. And I'm just going to say this. So the results are that you get, for the large volume model, you get genome masses, and in this large cycle volume dilute flux approximation, Gedini masses are given by a scale m. In terms of that, the scalar masses get a scale m over root 3. The A terms get a scale minus m. And the B terms get a scale minus 4m over 3. One comment to make is that these are universal because the scalar mass, soft scalar masses are proportional to the mass metric, and the A terms are proportional to the carbon couplings. This might seem a bit unnatural or unexpected, because there's a naive expectation that gravity mediation will always give non-universal soft terms, leading to flavor change neutral currents, leading to disaster. The reason for this expectation is quite simple to state, really. So it goes, flavor physics is Planck-scale physics, because it comes typically from the moduli to expectations. In gravity mediation, supersymmetry grating is also Planck-scale physics. It's coming from the Higgs sector, i.e. it's also coming from the moduli. So if both flavor physics comes from the moduli and supersymmetry grating comes from the moduli, then these things ought to talk to each other, and you expect the supersymmetry sector to see flavor. And if it's sensitive to flavor, the soft terms, which come from supersymmetry grating, should be non-universal. I think this argument is entirely correct in effective field theory, and I think it is wrong in string theory. The reason for it is that in string theory, you've got both Kähler and complex structure moduli, the T and the U moduli. And in leading order, it's very well known that these are actually decoupled. The Kähler potential is a function of the T moduli, plus a function of the U moduli, and also plus the S function of the S, the dilatant functions. And if you think about what actually happens in the 2D compact potentials, the complex structure moduli source flavor, because the superpotential can depend on the complex structure moduli, and at least at tree level, i.e. tertiary, it doesn't depend on the Kähler moduli. So because the superpotential y alpha beta is a function of the U moduli, the U, the complex structure moduli, are what give you the flavor structure. However, the supersymmetry breaking, at least in the kind of the explicit models, the way you normally do it, so you fix the complex structure moduli supersymmetrically by solving dw for 0, and then you get a potential from the K moduli which breaks supersymmetry. And so it's the T moduli that breaks supersymmetry and give you soft terms. So at leading order, your source of supersymmetry breaking, which is the T moduli, and your source of flavour, which is the U moduli, decouple. And this is what gives you universal flavour universality. And the origin of universality is the decoupling of Kähler, the complex structure moduli.
And that's the leading order in alpha prime of the statement, right? That K?
Yes.
And so to what extent are the corrections in alpha prime and string problems that are ruined all these conclusions? Okay, what about,
Other than roughly saying that it's a loop, it's ruined at the loop level.
So it's just string loop you're thinking, or is it? Since you know the volume, for instance, in the large volume case, do you know that the alpha prime corrections are scaling with some particular power of one over volume, which would make them extremely small, or is it?
Yes.
So the more recent thing would then be the string loop?
Yes, so if I can go back to. Okay, this expression. Okay, so we'd expect this to break down at the next order, this kind of universality to break down at the next order in tau s, which is the size of the small sample. And the kind of intuitive reason for this is that this is what sets, tau s sets the gauge coupling for the small sample. And this is where you've got wrapping the standard model. So any kind of loop effects see flavor. That's completely obvious, yeah, because the flavors are different masses, so loop effects are always sensitive to flavor. So you expect it to break down to loop expansion in tau s. So, but you don't say that this kind of flavor universality ought to break down at roughly one loop in the standard model gauge couplings.
But I'm really, if you go kind of back in the mists of time, from which I emerged, I remember there was a one of the arguments in the gravity case was that you would say that the gravity doesn't care about flavor largely. So you could imagine getting, for some reason that you maybe not understand until you get the string theory, you could get a flavor diagonal contribution at some high scale, like some of the low plank scale, at some very high scale. And then you integrate down to the weak scale to where you measure the flavor violation, and that normalization process is going to generate a whole bunch of flavor violation constraints. Are you making the argument here that normalization is not a problem?
No. So this is saying. this is saying that soft turns at the high scale would be flavor conversion.
Okay.
The thing that as you run down, you get. I mean, this is what always happens. I mean, it's most evident obviously in the third generation.
So this is making more precise the hope that of those days that the original thing coming in at high scales is already flavor.
Yes. Yes. Yes, so it's giving a kind of a specific stringy reason why that should happen. Okay, so you can run these soft terms to low energy using a program like SoftSusan, and you can study the spectrum. And again, I'm not going to go into much details, but I'm going to give you the graph. And this is after having imposed constraints like too much dark matter, what type of entropy, B2S gamma, muon, G minus 2, and so on. And there's a kind of an allowed region, which is bounded by, it's basically this region.
Here you just assume that you have the empty sounds.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this is a strong theoretical assumption that you've got just the empty schematic content between the weak scale and, in this case, the strict scale. But okay, so and now I want to, in the last 5 minutes.
So that generic statement, the generic flavor problem that you would have had at the weak scale from this running process, is this, if you make the assumption that you did that there's nothing but a standard for the MSSM between the high scale and low scale, are you finding that there's generically, so there's various constraints, but you've got a window which is not too small.
Yeah.
In getting that window, has it been true that generic size flavor changing things have been constrained to be extremely small by, the phenomenological constraints on flavor changing interference and things like that? So is the generic flavor violation, the CP violation problem, still there in these kind of models, or
my understanding is that the kind of flavor problems are most acute at what goes into the high scale. And that if you put universality in at the high scale, then you can be okay at the low scale. Because the two first two generations, which are where you've got the most stringent constraints, don't really separate that much.
Uh-huh.
And it's the third generation that really separates. But then that's also where the weakest bounds are. So this is imposing.
So the BDS gamma might be the third generation bounds, so that they're in there, but they're not super constraining.
No, yeah. I mean, they'll constrain it, but they're not kill it.
In phases, I mean, CP violation was always also true that you had lots and lots of phases you can have.
And so, again, I think that's something that at the high scale, that at the high scale, these are because something like so the H term is got the same phase as the gauge mass, so that's kind of takes out your CP phases that are problematic. So these soft terms at high energy, they don't suffer from the CP violation problems or the flavor problems.
What about the K total alpha beta bar? There's no phases in there.
This is real. This is the metric.
It's not just remission. It's real.
Or, well, so because, okay, let's put it this way. So because the mass is proportional to the metric, then when you diagonalize everything, you just get something which is just real and diagonal.
But that example is, so for instance, if alpha was a spork or something, when I get contributions from both m and y's, and where are you looking at relative phases between the k's and the...
Yeah, okay, so the same is because if your mass terms are... Because if the mass terms are exactly... So the general thing is, if the mass terms are exactly proportional to the mass matrix, and your a terms are exactly proportional to your Carnot couplings, then you don't have flavor problems, and you don't have CV problems.
The gym mechanism is going to carry through because everything's tied to what the quarks are doing.
Yeah, the way you kind of the set is the same track because you're trying the quarks to the quarks. Yeah. So what diagonalizes the quarks diagonalizes the quarks.
Yeah, but the M doesn't ruin that. That's what burns me a little bit.
The M, this M, or this.
That's right. Yeah, the matrix M, the alpha beta bar.
So this is the same thing, right? That this is because this is again saying that the squawks, physically the squawks are massive, the flavor universal.
Well, there are also the cases that when you generalize the K becomes generalizes.
But then I'm free to, if I, once I've done that and then I go to diagonalize the things from the Y's, I don't introduce.
The most important to the grammar is the most of the text in the contrast comes from the lot of the first interactions.
Oh, so the fermions also had to be put a little. See, I'm worried that the fermions would have had a different, the kinetic or the. If all you had were the Y's, then the fermions you diagonalize them as slowly the scalars, but the M alpha beta bars I thought were soft terms, so it says the scalars see them, but they.
So the fermions also have this.
Yeah, that's
true. Okay. So the last few minutes, I just want to talk about neutrino masses. Okay, so the theoretical origin of neutrino masses is a mystery. Experimentally, the heaviest neutrino has to lie somewhere between a 20th of an electron volt and about a third of an electron volt. And in the Cecil mechanism, this corresponds to a Majorana mass scale of about a few times 10 to the 14th JeV. So an equivalent way of stating this is that this is the suppression scale lambda of the dimension 5, the unique dimension 5, standard law operator, HH. Okay, so the question we can turn it around is, why is this scale what it is? Okay, so I'm going to do some similar tricks to what I was playing with the Carnot couplings. So in the emphasis ending in supergravity, consider the superpotential operator H2H2LL. Now, so I'm just assuming this is here. So this operator violates the Euler number. So I'm just, yeah, so it's, this is a straight assumption. Suppose this operator is here. Okay, then it's suppressed by the Planck scale because of supergravity, and lambda is dimensionless. So again, for the same reasons as before, this corresponds to the physical coupling, where you get a factor of e to the KO2, and then you get suppression by four factors of the metric, and you're going to get a square root for the same reason as you've got a square root before. The way you make this, everything canonically normalized, these are factors that come. Okay, so once the Higgs receives a bev, this term will generate a Majorana neutrino mass. And the question is, how big is it? Okay, so in the large volume models, we know that the mass metric scales like this. And if you plug all these things in, what you get for this suppression is you get the factor lambda remains, and you have volume to the one-thirds divided by the small size to two-thirds, and the couplings. We know that we want to have a TeV gravitational mass, so this corresponds to having a volume of about 10 to the 15, which is the ratio of the Planck scale to gravitational mass. And if you just plug these numbers in, you find that the scale you get here, basically because of the volume to the one-third, is 10 to the 14 JeV. So putting in the Higgs bev and assuming a large tan beta, you get a neutrino mass of about a third of an electron volt up to the coupling lambda, which is the right scale.
How did you fix tau s? Did knowing some, making some assumption about G-string?
No, tau s basically gives the standard model gauge couplings. So you
run. Right, I mean, if you know. It's a combination with G-string or tau s itself?
Tau s itself.
Oh.
Yeah. Because it's the DBI, because you've got the e to the minus phi. Yeah. It's just
I certainly see why it contributes, but you're saying it's the only factor.
Yes. Okay, so you just do plug for the light volumes, because I think they explain an awful lot with not putting very much in. So the exponentially large volume appears naturally. The stabilized volume goes as each constant over the G-string. So you can get huge volumes without any tuning. The volume required for TV scale supersymmetry automatically gives the correct scale for neutrino masses. Furthermore, this same volume also gives you the axial decay constant in the allowed order. And I think it's yoking of three distinct scales is very attractive, together with a natural solution of the hierarchy problem. And the origin of all these three hierarchies is the exponentially large volume.
But aren't it true that those same coincidences are the ones from the intermediate scale string?
Yes, it is an intermediate scale string.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
So this is the realization of that or something?
Yes. The thing about The neutrino masses might be aren't so obvious because you need the form of the K metric to show that the suppression scale is actually 10 to 14 Jev. Whereas maybe if the string scale is 10 to 11, you think the suppression scale is 10 to 11 Jev.
Except for a conversation we had on Tuesday, I would have said that's true. let me ask you about that.
So I just come to conclusions. Okay, so the conclusions. Okay. K-metrics for car and matter enter crucially into computation of OSM sometimes. Therefore, they're very important. I've described techniques allowing these to be computed in 2B RBL string classifications. Computed the modular weights both for one modulus KQLT models and for multi-modulus large volume models. The soft terms are flavor universal, which we traced to the decoupling of K-level complex structure modulus. And for the large volume models, TV scale supersymmetry also naturally gives the correct scale for neutrino masses. And that's it. Thank you.
I remember already doing talks on Joel was sitting around for the time. Joel, he's leaving early tomorrow. He's leaving on Friday, so he's going to be around the day. So thank you. Thank you.